Okay, hi folks. So this is kind of an eclectic talk and it relates to an email that I sent around a while ago as a result of some stuff that we were doing, and some of our stuff was breaking NTFS semantics or changing them at least in interesting ways. Okay, so I want to talk about, I want to ask a question, in fact, what's the craziest way to use Samba? And then talk about how Panzura is using Samba, and you're expected to make the association there. I want to talk about some of the problems that we have seen and with some of the problems that we're doing, and some changes that we are making. And at the end, I have some suggestions around things that could perhaps change in the protocol and so forth. But anyway, so what is the craziest way to use Samba? And I'm serious around that question. And what we've been doing is bending and twisting NTFS functionality for cloud access. Now, why is that? Panzura is a company that uses Samba to implement cloud gateways. What that means is that we, and actually I'll go on in a second, but we look like a NAS, and we have multiple of these gateways spread around the cloud. We do a bunch of caching, etc. And I'm going to use this diagram in or something similar to this diagram in all many of the future slides. So how do we do that then? So we call these things, internally we call these things cloud controllers, and it's a NAS. Each one of those cloud gateways is a NAS, runs FreeBSD, ZFS, and Samba. It runs quite a few other things as well. ZFS because it gave us the ability to extend the virtual address space, the file system virtual address space in some sense, into the cloud. We support NFS and SIFS, but I'll give you one guess on which one is most frequently used by our customers. It stores data and metadata in the cloud. It's encrypted as well so that customers can feel that their data is safe. And I think we use 256-bit encryption except for the export version or what have you, so that the NSA can pretend that they can't crack the 256-bit encryption, but they can crack the 128-bit encryption or whatever. We support quite a number of cloud backends. We used to support Nivonix when Nivonix was still around, but they're gone now. S3, Google, EMC's Atmos, private cloud stuff. We support versions of OpenStack by HP and maybe one other of the major vendors. And we've been doing some work on Azure, so that will likely be supported in the future. We have support for cloud mirroring. That step was kind of forced on us when Nivonix went away, so that we could easily move existing customers' data from the Nivonix cloud offering to another cloud offering. And data, as I mentioned before, data and metadata are sent to the cloud. We cache data and metadata, although metadata is more important than data. And we use Samba 3612. There's a small typo in the slide there. We've actually pulled in many of the patches from beyond 3.6.12. We hope to go to 4.x, 4.1 probably, or maybe 4.2 later this year, but for the moment we're using 3.6.6. And we have a reasonable number of customers out there. Some of them have quite large configurations with quite a number of cloud controllers. The Department of Justice is one of our customers with something like 50 of these things installed, and they've caused us no end of pain because they discovered a SMB signing bug with the compound support, and so we fixed that bug, and then they found another bug that wasn't our bug. It was a Cisco WAS bug, where again with SMB signing, where Cisco WAS was doing wrong stuff. They found quite a few others. as well. Some of our customers have latencies of 200 milliseconds or more from one cloud controller to another. One customer has cloud controllers in Shanghai and in Austin and in Romania and other places like that. I think they have a couple in India. And so the latencies between some of these machines can get fairly complex. Some of them have simple forests. Most of them have simple forests. Some of them have RODCs, and we've had to fix problems with the RODC support. There was one problem where while we supported RODC, when you went to join it, if the only local DC was an RODC, the join would fail, and so that stuff had to be fixed, and so on. So there's been quite a bit of interesting stuff, and we had a customer who managed to provoke the WinBind D 100% CPU utilization bug every 15 minutes, which is what finally allowed us to track that bug down and fix that particular bug, and so forth. Okay, so I've mentioned a number of these. Along the way as well, we've developed a little tool called an extension of SMB Cackles, called SMB X-Cackles. For anybody who is storing security descriptors in X-Adders, it would be useful, and I've seen this with two companies so far, where what you want to be able to do from shell scripts, etc., you want to be able to change the ACL on a share, especially at the root of a share. But if you use SMB Cackles, you have to go through SMBD and you have to have credentials. And oftentimes customers don't give you those credentials, and or you have to ask the customer to add those credentials or insert those credentials at startup time or something of that nature. This SMB X Cackles goes directly to the X-Adder where you're storing security descriptors and can display those and can modify those, so that typically when you're doing sysadmin, you're running as root anyway, and so you can set up new default ACLs or things of that nature. And we've posted around the changes, but I'm trying to want to clean them up at some stage and make them more generally available and maybe merge them with NFS v4 ACL support, so that you can do it from the command line without having to use credentials. Okay, so now getting more into the meat of things. So each Samba instance is a separate Samba instance, and our setup is kind of like a shared nothing cluster, where each of those Samba instances are not sharing any information, but they now do talk to each other to find out certain pieces of information, and maybe you'll spot some of the problems with doing that as we go through. And we've gone through an evolution in our use of Samba. Initially, it was very simple. Each of those cloud controllers had a separate instance of Samba, and they really didn't know about each other. And then we made it less simple, and then we made it even less simple, and so forth. So as things have gone by, things have become less simple. So what's happening in our cloud controllers is that when you write data to a cloud controller here from a client, we are using the ZFS snapshotting capability, and these snapshots are being sent to the cloud. There are separate metadata and data snapshots being sent to the cloud, and we are also fetching from the cloud metadata snapshots that have been uploaded by the other CCs in this cluster. So each of the cloud controllers can see the file system in some sense on all of the other cloud controllers, and I'll talk to you in a bit about what that means. We don't have to fetch the data at that point. We do a lazy fetch of the data I think I mentioned that here. So these snapshots that are going up to the cloud are done on a time basis and an amount of change basis. So if there's more than 32 meg of change, or in some cases it's smaller than that, or 60 seconds have elapsed since the last snapshot, we send those up to the cloud. We send data to the cloud first, because if we go back here, well, we actually allow some customers to do it the other way around, but that's a pain in the ass. The problem is, if we send metadata to the cloud, the other node is going to, other nodes are going to pull that metadata down. Now they know about the namespace. Then when they ask for the data block, it may not yet be in the cloud, and you get into bad situations where you don't know what to do because you can't find that data block as yet from the cloud. So typically, when we push data, we push, the default behavior is to push the data first, so that when the metadata snapshots get into the cloud, you can see that. However, there is a problem, of course, because those other CCs, there is now an event horizon, because a remote CC will not see your local changes for up to 60 seconds. Now, as far as fetching data is concerned, we can specify, or customers can specify, pinning rules as well, so that as soon as a cloud controller sees some new metadata, a new file for example, it will also immediately fetch the data so that it's in the local cache, so that when they go to access it, it is they don't have to wait to retrieve that data. But any local disk is really a cache for the data, so that data could get evicted as well. Now, so each of the cloud controllers can see each file system here, and all but the local file system are read-only. And so in these two cloud controllers here, what you see is on CC1 here, it has /CFS, which is short for CloudFS, /CC1, which is the read-write file system on this side, and /CFS/CC2, which is the read-only file system because it belongs to the other side, and vice versa over there. So, and again, I'm reiterating, there is a delay, there is an event horizon-like effect, and that presents us, has presented us with some problems that we've had to paper over. So, however, initially, customers found this a reasonable concept. They found it usable because what they could do is they could push stuff into the cloud on this side, and a little bit later, if they needed to, they could suck it out of the cloud on the other side, and vice versa. Electronic Arts is a company that uses this sort of setup, and they take advantage of dedupe and features like that, and they will in their they're also located in Austin, I think, but they have an office in Berkeley. When they're developing a new game, for example, they will start pushing the images into the cloud, and then they will pull it out in Shanghai where they're doing localization or whatever. And after they have pushed a few versions of this game in the cloud, there starts to be enough dedupe going on between one version and the next version that subsequent versions do not need a lot of data or metadata going into the cloud, and pulling it out at the other end is also relatively fast because all they need to fetch is the blocks that are different. So it was a reasonably compelling story for some people. Unfortunately, other customers decided that they needed more functionality. And in particular, what they decided is that what they needed to be able to do is they needed to be able to push a file in on this side, and then they needed to be able to modify that same file somewhere else in the cloud, on one of the other CCs, and then they needed to be able to perhaps modify it on this side. And so to avoid problems with corruption of data, we introduced this concept of ownership of files. And when someone opened a file for write access, if they were allowed to, we would transfer ownership from one cloud controller to another cloud controller. And it's a fairly gross concept there. It's a fairly gross way of doing things. But it worked for a while as well. And so underlying all of that, what we were doing is on open, we were rsyncing the contents from one node to the other. That's fine. You know, you've got 60 seconds before Windows says, look, I'm sorry, I just can't wait around any longer. And so, you know, if you had multi-gigabyte file that you were trying to transfer, you would have problems. And what we did as well was we said that, you know, transfer of ownership happened when someone wanted write access to the file. Everybody else who tried to access that file got sharing violation. But then later on, we had to change things as well. Customers wanted more, and in particular, there were a whole bunch of additional problems. As I mentioned before, we were rsyncing as well, and if they had a multi-gigabyte file, rsync has a problem, especially with some of the latencies that we're talking about. We've since changed, or we're in the process of changing that, because ZFS has its own block checksums, and so we could use the ZFS block checksums to speed up that process by one or two orders of magnitude. So we're moving down that path as well. Now, what happened then? So then the next problem was that we discovered Office. I mean, we'd known about Office before all along, of course, but we discovered that some of our customers wanted to use Office. And in particular, some of our customers wanted to be able to open an Office document over here, and then others elsewhere, somewhere in the world, wanted to be able to open the same Office document, and they wanted to be told, hey, someone else is already editing that, and so you have to wait. And all of this revolves around things like sharing violation and getting things right when you open the file. So we had to change stuff somewhat. And so we then started introducing this notion that the instance of Samba over here, if you're trying to open a document and it's owned by another node, we would send a request to the other CC saying, hey, does anybody have this document locked? And if so, tell me what it is about. And then we would send back the appropriate sharing violations. And after a while, we actually got this stuff to work okay, such that people could genuinely run Office, open a document on a cloud controller in Austin, and they could try to open the same document in Shanghai or somewhere, and things would work reasonably well. Yes. Well, at open time, people tolerate long open latencies. So all of that stuff is happening at open time. But it can get very slow, and I'll talk about a case where we couldn't tolerate those really, really long latencies, and we couldn't tolerate rsync. But then we came on this concrete example of where sharing violation was really good. And our QA folks discovered this. They were running tests where they would try to create a new folder here and concurrently try to create a new folder on another CC. Now, they were in the same office, of course, but they were simulating this environment. And what we discovered was that the Explorer, when you create a new folder, it first sends a find request to see if the folder already exists. And of course, it gets back object name not found. So then it sends a create request to create the folder. Unfortunately, with these sorts of latencies going on, it's possible for someone else to sneak in between and create the folder. And the Explorer crashes when that happens. When it gets back object name collision after it was just told object name not found, it crashes. Now, it's actually very hard to provoke this on a single NAS situation, and I suspect because the amount of time between those two is very, very short. However, we were getting these crashes, and none of our customers have seen this, but QA was annoying us about it. So we said, well, maybe if we send back sharing violation, it'll work. And so we modified the code so it sent back sharing violation in that situation. And lo and behold, the Explorer didn't crash. And so we were happy. In engineering, we were happy. Unfortunately, some of our customers depend upon the other behavior. So we had to back that fix out and live with the fact that we can crash the Explorer because of opening up this window wider in our environment. So, okay, how am I going? I've got... Okay, and then it'll probably be some time for questions, yeah. It was on Windows 7 that they were testing with. And we can go through and check with some others. And I imagine that it's not something that you would even think to test for, because it's very, very hard to provoke that sort of thing. Okay, so our customers kept asking us to do more and more, you know, what they would consider were reasonable things, and we would consider unreasonable given the sort of model that we've got. But anyway, the next one we came across was this application called Revit. It's an application that's owned by Autodesk and is used for managing large-scale buildings like airports and other large-scale buildings. And their software has this notion of a collaborative mode where a whole lot of architects or engineers can collaborate on the design of a building. And they manage this by storing a whole lot of information on a share in a NAS. And they have a directory called Project Name Under Backup, where they keep lots of interesting files. Apparently it's all hooked together with an OLEDB, they use OLEDB. We didn't know that when we first started trying to make this stuff work. But we do know it now. And they have another directory in there called the Revit Temp directory. And they do lots of weird sorts of things that have stressed our implementation quite a lot. Much of it uses sharing modes, etc., and we've kind of worked our way around that. But some of the more interesting things they're doing is they keep this file called the S-log file. The S-log file is actually a log of the activity that Revit has gone through during use of the application. And their model is each user will actually store their in-progress modifications on the local client. And when they're ready to commit that stuff, they synchronize with the central. They push it up to the central site. And they have this cute application that users can run that will show them who else is editing the model and who else and what they are doing. If they're synchronizing with Central, it puts up this little status bar, and so everybody can see the status of your synchronization attempts. And it's kind of an interesting way that they do things. They write information to this S-log file, and the little application that monitors what people are doing reads that S-log file, and it reads a few other files as well. Unfortunately, they need byte range locks. Now, so we sort of said, damn, they need byte range locks, because we don't have a generic byte range lock implementation in this sort of environment, because it's very hard. So we looked at what they were doing, and we discovered that they actually only need a very special case of byte range locks, because all they do is append to this S-log file. And what they do then is they run a very simple locking protocol. They lock from what they think is the current end of the file for 64K. And when they get the lock, they then find out where the real end of file is. They write their record to the end of file, and then they unlock it. That's a little bit dangerous, because if there's more than, because they're continually writing records to this file, and if there's more than about 16 or 20 users who are editing the same model, then they will likely, in fact, cause corruption, because they will be overwriting the wrong place. But that's what they're doing, and so we then changed our implementation so that we could support this append-only byte range lock setup across the cloud. And we have essentially made all of that work. But then we discovered a bunch of other problems because Revit makes Revit just thinks that it's running on a normal Windows server, and so we have to handle a bunch of these things, these problems. One of those is that some of the files that I mentioned before, in fact, a lot of the files, they open a lot of these files for read access, especially when they're synchronizing. And if we were rsyncing these files every time they open a file for read access that has not changed, then that's going to introduce a lot of delay because of the latencies involved. And so to overcome that, what we've done is implemented a distributed change notify between our CCs so that when somebody over here who has the file open for write, when they close it and they have modified the file, we then broadcast to all of the other cloud controllers a notice, a message saying this file has changed, so that anybody else who opens the file for read will only rsync when they know that the file has been modified. So that was one of the things that we had to fix. Then another thing that we had to fix was, or we discovered, was that, by the way, oplocks cause us problems. And that's because, again, we have this essentially shared none environment. And if a client over there on CC2 has opened a file and has asked for a batch oplock, Samba will hand out the batch oplock, then the client closes the file, or rather the application closes the file, but the redirector doesn't let it go. The redirector keeps it open because they've got a batch oplock and is hoping that the user will open that file again and it doesn't have to suffer the problems to do with getting the open to the server again. So the implementation, the instance of Samba on CC2 doesn't know that the file is closed. And then when somebody over here tries to open the same file, we send a request across to CC2 saying, can we open this file? And they say no, because it's still open. So we've had to implement a distributed oplock break protocol in here as well. And so when we try to open the file and we know that it's likely open, when we know that the ownership was transferred over to the other side, then we send a request over here saying, can we open it? As a side effect of this, can we open it? The Samba instance on CC2 sends an oplock break on that file. If we're lucky, and usually with Revit, this is what has happened, the client, the application has closed the file, the oplock break causes the close to be sent back to the CC, to the cloud controller, and then we can get the file open on this side. So we've had to... Well, so actually, we do that in some instances as well, but if we did it in general, the application gets very annoyed because of all the extra opens. They do reopen some files enough. So one of the files that they deal with, they only write it once every 60 seconds or so. That one we can just disable. Oplocks, handle caching and oplocks on that file. But some of the others, they open so frequently that it's annoying. In fact, one of them, where we've had to use quite a lot of techniques is that their little application that monitors who is in the model opens, it allows you to choose or control how frequently you want to update the display around who's there. The default behavior is 200 milliseconds, once every 5 seconds. And so if you have enough users using this, you have a ton of create requests coming to the server, and it gets difficult. But yes, so we've done that in some cases where we just deny oplocks. Okay. So one of the problems then is that the approach that we've chosen to take has probably fallen on the wrong side of the centralized versus distributed metadata argument. And we are in the future going to have to probably migrate to some sort of centralized metadata for some of these things. But in addition, I think we're going to see more and more applications trying to live in this sort of an environment where they're trying to provide distributed application without necessarily having totally centralized metadata. And there are a couple of lessons, I think, that we've learned and might be useful elsewhere. One is that Office applications do this funny dance when they're saving the file, where they open the file and they create their own temporary file while they're editing, and they leave the original file name there. They create a few other file names as well. Then when it comes time to save that file, they then go and rename the original file and then rename their temporary file to the original name. And then they delete the file that you've just superseded. This, of course, is quite racy, and it would have been better if Win32 had if there were a Win32 call which said, here's two file names, I want you to swap these two file names so that the one that was the original now has the name of your temporary file or some other name, and the one that was your temporary now has the original name, so that there was a non-racy version of such things. And it turns out, I believe, that Linux already has a rename to call or something like that. I forget the details. And it's probably not a good idea to use racy create-like approaches in for these sorts of applications. But one other thing that it strikes me that would be useful is that it is probably time to start thinking about making it possible for applications and application developers to signal to the file system the sort of consistency requirements that they have for files. And you know, whether or not they are happy with eventual consistency, or whether they really need strong read after write consistency, and if they are prepared to tolerate some sort of eventual consistency on these files, how long they are prepared to wait before they expect the file system on the local node to be consistent. And it would be interesting to have some sort of discussions around providing exactly those sorts of things. But beyond that, I don't have any big new suggestions. Yes?
Most clouds make that sort of an opt-in. You actually have to pay more for stronger consistency guarantees.
Right, but the other thing is that most cloud implementations are using a REST implementation where you're talking to objects. The problem, I guess,
but you might write over here but read over there. That's
yes.
The problem. So, right?
Yes, indeed. But then the extra problem is that in our case, what we're trying to do is to provide a traditional file-like semantics on top of a cloud that doesn't have those semantics.
Right. But my point is that you could opt in. The application or the file share or the file tree could
right.
opt into that kind of behavior.
Yes, they could. Although the way many things are at the moment is that you kind of have to do it on a share basis or something of that nature, or a file system basis. What would be nice is if applications could say, or administrators could say, for these directories, for this directory tree, I want this semantic, and for others, I'm prepared to live with the eventual consistency issues or things of that nature. Okay, I think that's all that I have. The other thing is that but Tom has mentioned this already on another venue, it's time, I think, to start thinking about extending or making it possible on Unix systems for applications to say what sort of sharing they will tolerate on files. Because it allows the file system to use that information to make decisions about what it's going to do with respect to those files. Okay, so any questions? Yes, Ralph.
Would there be any disadvantages for you by using CTDB instead of your own
right.
solution?
So this question has come up quite a lot. Our problem is that, I guess it was twofold. One is that CTDB is quite sort of deeply embedded in Samba, although there is an API that we could have worked with and modified. But the other problem was our perception, at least, that because we have quite large latencies, we have WAN-like latencies, that and CTDB depends upon LAN-like latencies, or rather would probably not work too well without LAN-like latencies. We decided not to go down that path. Steve, did you have a question?
So these consistency requirements on open.
Yes.
So are you thinking of those in sort of related to extending the, like a create context for open?
In the Unix file system or?
Well, I mean, In a perfect world, we would be able to pass end-to-end the consistency requirements, just like we can pass, in theory, end-to-end sequential, random, and certain other behaviors on the open and flags. And one of the things we've looked at, and one of the things Volcker's prototyped, is, you know, saying, okay, we've got an optional POSIX context, and if you send this thing, it gives you extra information. And you can even imagine in a gateway world where you could add on to the create context on the, you know, pass an open, have a, you know, a proxy or something fill in additional information. But one of the things that I wasn't sure about is whether you were thinking in terms of like extending the sort of create context that Volcker had been talking about, or whether this was limited just to sort of like VFS kind of stuff.
So at the moment it's limited to VFS stuff, and I wasn't aware of the work that Volcker was doing with respect to those create contexts. But that would be a useful approach to doing things. What I should emphasize is that as a result of the recent work that we did to handle the S-log file, we had to, for the S-log file in particular, create time consistency was not good enough because of these byte range locks and the fact that they're doing appends. And so we actually do, when the lock request comes in, we're actually synchronizing the file at that point. But it turns out that because of the nature of the file, we can actually piggyback the data differences because we know a whole bunch of things about this file. We don't have to run rsync, and in fact, well, initially we were running rsync to do that, and that just turned out to be too expensive, and so we have another approach to that synchronization.
I guess you just answered my question, but I ask anyhow. Did you implement this, the share modes and oblock stuff based on just VFS, or did you have to change something in the Samba code outside VFS?
Right. So the share modes was based just on the VFS, as I recall, because in the create call you get all of that information, although and in SMB Open that code is located for us in the open call, but you get an FSP in the open call, and so you have that information. But delete on close caused us some problems, and so we had to add another VFS function to check remote delete on close. Now, the thing to be aware of is that what we are doing at the moment as well will cause a semantic gap. So if you think about, let me go back a couple of slides here. Okay, so to this slide, what we are doing is a pairwise evaluation of sharing modes. Now, that's not semantically correct. You can easily think of situations where we would possibly actually allow an open that Windows would fail. There are going to be situations as well where we would fail an open that Windows would allow. That's not too bad, but if we were to allow an open that Windows would fail, then we have violated probably some requirements that the applications would have. And so we're going to have to do more work in there. And that's why I mentioned towards the end that we need to think about moving to a model where at least some of the metadata is centrally located. Fortunately, it's metadata that is only needed while files are open, so we can potentially deal with that. Delete on close provides similar problems because we're doing pairwise evaluation of delete on close.
Okay, actually I have one short one. Would this work with more than two cloud controllers?
So it does work with more than two cloud controllers. We've got work in there for more than, we've got code in there for dealing with more than two cloud controllers. However, it still creates the problems that I mentioned in that we are doing pairwise evaluations, and so that can provide for a semantic gap.
Okay, and you mentioned dedupe in the beginning of your talk. So how is the dedupe done?
It's actually just standard ZFS dedupe. ZFS has block checksums, and so we are checking those block checksums. And if it's already in the cloud, we don't send that block.
Thank you very much.